Okay, let's do some quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on multiple systems, on delivering your product or service, the more margin you have and the more money you keep. That's obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. To reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. Here's the thing. Information is power. Information is money. Literally, the currency of today's world of entrepreneurship is information. And if you could bring all of the information about your business into one dashboard, this is incredibly valuable. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, HR into one platform and one source of the truth about your business. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required, access from anywhere. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified business management suite. And you're improving efficiency by bringing all of your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. This is so valuable. You just hit a button and you can see all the information about your business instead of having to like call five different departments and get all these emails and put it all together and make sense of it. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move. So do the math, see how you'll profit with NetSuite. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/James. netsuite.com/James. netsuite.com/James.
James Altucher at the James Altucher Show, and I have a very special guest today. But first, welcome to my co-host, Aaron Brabham. Aaron, how's it going?
Man, I'm doing great, James. It's another beautiful sunny day in Orlando, although it's a bit chilly, only high of 63 today. But
don't make me jealous. It's you know it's -3 degrees here in New York. So
I didn't even know that.
Just
James.
Rubbing
I'm
it
sorry.
In.
I know. All right. So, James, look, you know, for all of your guests, I always know the name in the very least, if not I'm very familiar with the work with their work. But today I was unfamiliar with your guest's name, so I had to do a little research. But I want you to tell, you know, your listeners who the guest is and why you decided to have him on your show.
Sure. First off, his name's Hugh Howey. He's the best-selling author of The Wool series. Is a science fiction series, and there's something very unique about this series in that it was self-published. He had no publisher for it. He just basically uploaded his files to Amazon, published the book. As he explains in the interview, well, you'll see, it was his 9th book that he had self-published, and the book just took off and became this massive bestseller. He's made, I don't know, 7 figures on these books. You know, he wrote an entire series and then another series after that. Ridley Scott bought the movie rights. And so 2 years ago, or 2.5 years ago, this guy was shelving books in a bookstore, making 10 bucks an hour. And then choosing himself by, you know, a lot of people want to be writers, but they get rejected by the publishing industry and they give up. He chose himself. He uploaded the files to Amazon. He published himself. And after the course of 9 novels, a book finally hit the bestseller list, and he quit his job. He's made his own career. And many people have done this. He's not the only one. And we discussed this on the interview. So it's really a fascinating way to choose yourself. And it's a vehicle that's open to anyone. And I want to tell you one other thing. I just came back from Amazon, where I was visiting their self-publishing group. And those guys, all they think about is how they can help writers self-publish more books, make more money. They're very writer-oriented, and it's just an excellent vehicle for choosing yourself, and Hugh Howey is a great example of it. Plus, by the way, he's an excellent writer. I mean, I highly recommend not only the Wool series, but many of his books.
Yeah, that's outstanding. You know, it's good to see that Amazon is still sticking to their roots, you know, because they originally started their company for book publishing. And, you know, of course, it's transformed with the Kindle and, you know, your Choose Yourself book was huge, and you self-published it through some of their software. So it makes me happy to hear that they still have their roots. Well, James, let's not delay any further. Let's jump right into the interview.
Great, Aaron. Thanks. So, Hugh Howie, welcome to the show.
Thanks, James. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, and Hugh, many of the listeners might not know exactly who you are, but I'll give a brief bio, and then I have some questions about your bio, which you could elaborate on. But basically, you're the best-selling author of Wool, and essentially you've written about, I think, about 24 novels that are on Amazon, or were bought by Ridley Scott. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's the number of novels is probably inflated by the fact that some were serialized, but yeah, maybe 15 or so novels. And
oh, that, okay, and only 15 novels. Only 10 more than Thomas Pynchon has written.
Well, I think Thomas would say that he aims for quality over quantity. I don't know.
I don't know. I've read a good chunk of your novels. You know, if you've written 15, I've probably read at least like 8 or 9 of them. And I would say you have very high quality. But what's really interesting in your story, there's two things that are interesting that I want to get to. One is how you got to be a best-selling novelist was a very unique path that most people have not taken. And I think it's a path that could be actually followed by many people who listen to this podcast to some extent, not maybe to the highest extent, but to some extent. And then I think also you have a site, authorearnings.com, which discusses kind of the pros and cons of the particular approach you've taken. So I want to get right into that, but I want to start off with a little more background. While you're writing, or basically before you started selling big quantities of fiction, what were you doing? What were you doing for a living?
Yeah, I was paying my bills as a bookseller. When I wrote my first novel, I was out of work. I was trying to help launch a website doing book reviews, and I was covering the book industry from the inside, doing interviews with authors, going to book conferences, trying to review a book a day.
And so you were using the World Wide Web?
Yeah, I was using the World Wide Web. I was on the internet.
And the internet, okay. It's a new technology. So, yeah. And how did that work out for you?
Well, it worked out great because it motivated me to write my own book. It didn't work out so well for the website because I got lost writing my own novels. And I was doing 90% of the work on the website. So the website foundered after that. But
did it motivate you because were you thinking to yourself, and I'm just maybe, you know, were you thinking, gosh, these guys suck so bad, I could write a novel better than them?
No way. What happened, I started going to these conferences and meeting, well, I was doing interviews. I was doing at least one interview a week with really top-notch writers. And I was going to conferences and meeting them. And what was cool was learning how down-to-earth and normal these people were and the fact that they all had day jobs. And the only thing different with them and myself was they got up every morning and spent a couple hours writing. And I realized I was doing the same thing.
What time would they wake up?
Website. Oh, it varies. But most of them had to write before they went to work. A lot of them were university professors or they had jobs in journalism. And so they devoted a couple hours here and there. Yeah, some of them, you know, what I modeled myself on were the writers who were getting up at 5 o'clock in the morning to write before they went into their day job.
Wow. And so they weren't making a living from their writing. It was just sort of out of the pleasure of writing fiction and having it published and having a few readers that drove them to this.
Yeah. And some of these were New York Times bestselling authors. I assumed they were millionaires. And that started dispelling to me the fantastical image I had of what a writer's life was like. And that helped me. I don't know. I think not putting authors on pedestals has been crucial to me visualizing myself as an author. I don't have delusions of grandeur. And I thought writers were some kind of special magical beast. And it was really nice to get to know them and for them to offer encouragement. And I realized I was writing a couple hours every day for the website and for my blog. So why not put that time into writing the fiction that I've always dreamed of writing?
And so did that disturb you a little bit, though, that they were New York Times bestsellers and they weren't making a living at it? They still had to, like, teach or be a journalist or whatever. Did that strike you that maybe the system was broken a little bit? Because a New York Times bestseller is going to sell, like, what, 30 to 50,000 books in a couple weeks. That strikes me as a way to make a living.
Yeah, some of them, you know, you don't have to sell quite that many to hit the list. It's especially those who are nonfiction New York Times bestsellers. It's pretty startling how you can creep onto the list with just a few thousand hardback sales in the opening week by targeting certain bookstores that report their sales. It's and being a New York Times bestselling author is something that follows you for life. So some of the authors that I met in my bookstore were New York Times bestselling authors, but they hadn't hit the list in several years. And so you're trying to live off of, for some it's maybe $25,000 or $50,000 advance. And after your agent and your taxes, you're looking at trying to live off of, you know, $25,000 or $30,000, even on that high end.
And so even a New York Times bestseller, they're only going to get a $25,000 advance on their next book on average, would you say?
I don't know what the average would be, but I mean, I can only talk about the anecdotal numbers that people would share with me. And the six-figure advance, you know, kind of had its heyday for a while, but it's very few authors who get that much money up front. For a debuting author, the number that I see most often is around $5,000 as an average. Of course, the ones you hear about are the six- and seven-figure offers. I think it's dangerous to model our expectations around the outliers. And I'm an outlier in the self-publishing world, and there are outliers in the traditional publishing world, but most people don't get deals like that.
Well, so you were doing this website and talking to lots of authors, and then you decided to devote your time more to your own fiction. This was like inspirational to you, talking to these authors. What happened next in terms of making a living?
Well, not much. I wrote my first book and I planned on giving it away, and I gave it to friends and family, and some the feedback was that I should try to get this published, and it was better than the last thing they had read from the bookstore. Quite a few people told me that. So I started doing some research to find out what that was involved in getting a book published, and learned about the query letter, which I found was more difficult to write than the novel itself. That one page took as much time as almost as much time as writing the 100,000 word novel. And
this is the letter that you would send to publishers describing your book.
Right. This is you going from being a fiction writer to a business pitch artist. So, I found it very difficult to write like a one paragraph synopsis of either who I am or what the book was and why this agent should care about it. So, but I did that for a few weeks, sent it to agents and to small presses that took unagented submissions. And I got two small presses interested. One made an offer that I was happy with, and, I was shocked that someone was going to pay me money for this manuscript. It was very little money, but it was, I anticipated having to spend money to self-publish it. So, to kind of cut to where I am now, it went well, but I saw that the tools they were using.
I'm sorry, Hugh, but what was the title of that book?
Molly Fide and the Parsona Rescue.
Oh, okay, great. And then you continued to write a series on that.
Yeah, when I published the second book, I had an offer from the publisher. They sent me a contract for the second book, and I thought, you know, I think I can do everything that they're doing on my own and have more creative control and quicker time to market, and I would keep a larger share of the earnings. So this time I wasn't thinking about ebooks at all. I was producing ebooks, but they were an afterthought. And so,
what wasn't the publisher doing that you felt you could do?
They were doing a good job. It's just I wanted to change small things throughout the process, and that felt annoying. I felt like I was annoying them to have to email them and say, "Could we tweak the back jacket this way?" I wanted to fire up InDesign and Photoshop and do some of the stuff myself, and it seemed to be quicker that way. And I was also doing a lot of research on which print on demand company to use and how to do the ebook things that they weren't doing yet, and what their publishing model. And I saw that maybe these were helpful avenues to explore. And then I was walking them through using Lightning Source to try to get Baker and Taylor and Barnes and Noble distribution. And I started thinking, man, I'm doing a lot of the publishing work on my own. Why not just take on a few extra things and like the editing and hire that out and strike out on my own, basically do what they're doing.
So striking out on your own, of course, makes a big difference financially, because instead of getting, I don't know what your royalty was, but instead of getting, let's say, a 15% royalty, you could get 80-90%, or Amazon has 70%. I don't know, you know, how that financially affected you given the advances that you were getting from the small publisher, but I can't imagine they were giving huge advances either.
No, they weren't. And I, yeah, you know, it wasn't all financial, but it definitely paid dividends. You know, I started within a year of writing, I was making at least $100 a month, which to me, I lived on a very small budget and never dreamed that people were going to pay for my writing. So having my cable bill paid by my hobby every month was pretty startling. And I think that was only because I was in control of it all.
So Hugh, you wrote the first novel, you did it with a small press, and then what got you from writing like one novel to having this huge amount of novels and then making a living from it? Like, what were you doing? What changed?
I think the biggest thing, I think this is the difference in the two methods of publishing now. I have friends who have published through traditional publishers who were given one or two books to hit it big. And if they didn't have a blockbuster, there were enough other up and comers for publishers to choose from that someone else was given a chance. And I was able to kind of ignore that, the challenge of continuously writing books and selling them to publishers and just concentrate on the writing itself. I know that sounds counterintuitive. You would think that a self-published author would spend more time doing other things. But when I got busy was later in my career when I signed on with publishers. When I was working at a bookstore, I just spent my time writing the stories that I enjoyed and getting them out there and then moving on to the next one. I didn't worry about how that book was selling. I didn't spend a lot of time promoting it. I didn't care what the rankings or sales were doing on that book. My idea was, I love writing now. I'm going to spend 10 years writing. And later in life, I might have 20 or 30 novels that I can tell people that I wrote and, you know, set up a booth in a arts and crafts show or go to book conferences and set up a table. But, you know, I wasn't going to make it with one book. I was going to have to write all the stories that were in my head and get them all available. And they weren't getting old. It wasn't like they were dying on the vine. They were brand new to everyone who hadn't discovered them yet.
So you basically, you were working in a bookstore, but you felt your best marketing for your books, in some sense, was writing a new book.
Absolutely. Yeah. For me, well, I think part of what motivated me was 20 years of wanting to be a writer and not being able to finish a novel or putting it off, procrastinating and feeling like this is something I would never get done. And when I finished that first novel and realized that I could do it, it was almost like summiting my first mountain. And I got so addicted to the high of being up there and feeling that sense of accomplishment that all I wanted to do was go climb another peak. I didn't want to go around the country showing people slides of my mountaineering exploits and try to be someone who spoke about mountaining. I wanted to do it again. So my passion was writing, and it, you know, I say this kind of with a lot of snark, but unfortunately I didn't get 10 years of writing in before things took off. I was just putting books out there, and I think within 2 or 3 years I had about 5,000 books sold, which is what I planned to do in my lifetime if I was lucky to sell that many books. So you can see I had very low expectations this whole time. But then this one short story I threw up there took off and kind of gave me an opportunity to focus my efforts on this series. And the sales got to the point that I could quit my day job and really focus everything on my writing career.
And this was Wool, right?
Yeah, it started off as a short story.
Well, it's interesting because you call it a short story, but it was about 70 pages, Wool 1.
Yeah, I think it's 12,000 words. So when it's formatted by itself, it's about 40 pages long. I guess it's considered a novelette would be its technical term.
And then so you wrote Wool 1 through 4, and then you did the Wool Omnibus, which is when I read it. It by that point, it had really taken off. I mean, your Wool 1 through 4 plus the Omnibus was like 1 through 5 on Amazon science fiction list.
Yeah, and that was an unexpected benefit of having written it in parts, but the exposure of the series was, you know, if you see one book in a bestseller list, it looks like every other title, it just blends in. But when all five of the parts of Wool were all sprinkled throughout the list and all kind of climbed together. I think they gave the series a lot more visibility, and they supported one another. And but yeah, at one point it was pretty obnoxious. You would get on Amazon and you would see all five parts in the top 10. When I combined them into the omnibus, those individual parts kind of died down, and the standalone novel is what went on to hit the New York Times list and do really well by itself.
And at this point, were you still working in a bookstore?
Yeah, I was right up until, I think my last day was right around when the omnibus was released, because even when I only had three or four parts out, I was making as much in a day as I made in a week at the bookstore. You know, I was working a 30-hour job for $10 an hour. And the reason that job really allowed me a lot of time to write. And what time I wasn't writing, I was spending around books. I was doing a lot of like author events and dealing with reps from publishing houses. And yeah, it was very useful, I think, just to have those years spent in a bookstore while I was writing. It taught me a lot about the industry.
Bookstore jealous that they had like this writer there, or did they all have their kind of novel in a desk drawer that they wanted to put out?
No, my boss, who sat right beside me, it was really just the two of us ran the bookstore, and we had some student employees who filled in every now and then, but the two of us ran the bookstore. And he didn't really think of me as a real writer because I was writing genre fiction, and he's still a really good friend of mine, but I think he's baffled by it all, because, you know, he really loves literary fiction and that's what he likes to write. I like to read literary fiction as well, so we have a lot of the same tastes. But he did not like to shelve, you know, science fiction or young adult up on the front shelves, and I was always fighting to get those books better placement. So yeah, we had a fun relationship, and I think when the series started blowing up, he was pretty baffled by it all.
And then okay, the series started blowing up, and you quit the job to do this full time. What did you do with this new time? Were you writing more? I mean, or were you dealing more with the publishing side of the business?
I would say I was writing about the same amount. My day job was replaced with a day job spent answering emails and doing a lot of traveling, dealing with demands from agents and publishers and people who wanted me to come to conferences and a lot of social media interaction. You know, my thrill with having a readership has been having something in common with all these strangers online. And so my use of social media has basically been to make myself available to existing readers. I don't really use social media to try to win over new readers. I just don't think that works very well. So I became really swamped with emails and contacts on Facebook and through Twitter. And I would spend a couple hours a day just handling those sorts of things.
Wow. It's really the opposite of a lot of marketing efforts of writers, where they do use those, you know, like a publisher will ask you, what's your social media platform like? Because they expect you to, the average writer to use the social media platform to sell books, but you were using it more to build community among existing readers. And I think that worked very well for you.
I think it works better, because it's disingenuous, I think, for a writer to tell strangers, you're going to love my book, or my book is great. Or maybe that just takes some kind of self-confidence that I don't have. But I think it's more effective to have a great relationship with your existing readers. And those are the people who are going around telling other people you should check out this work. I mean, I don't read books that are recommended to me from publishers and authors, people who have a financial stake in my decision, because I don't know what their I guess I know what their goal is. Their goal is to make money off me, and I understand that completely, but I would rather listen to my friends and family whose goal is to make me happy with a good book. And I think those are the people we listen to more. We trust friends and family and word of mouth more than we trust either a paid critic or the people who have a financial stake in that product.
Well, it's interesting, because after I became a fan of your books, I also found books that you would either blurb or mention. So, for instance, I really like the Marcus Shaky book Brilliance, because on your recommendation, I never would have known about it. So that's really true. I wanted to get into kind of the technical details at this point. So essentially, you know, what was your writing schedule like at this point? And then just technically, how did you publish? Like what platforms you used and so on? How did you get your book out there? Books.
Well, I'm more creative in the morning. I do my best writing early when my kind of my dream state, I guess, is still lingering. I find my vocabulary is a little more, it's not that the correct word is always available. It's just that I use more creative word sentence structures early in the morning. And a lot of times I have to revise those things to make sense of it later in the process, which I do better in the afternoon. So, you know, everyone has to figure that out for themselves. There's no right answer for when to write. You just, the right answer is to find time to write. The people who are doing it wrong are the people who think they don't have time in the day to do it.
Why do you think they think that? And then they watch 4 hours a night of TV. Like what things did you have to eliminate in your schedule to find the time to write? Because you already had a schedule, so you had to eliminate something in order to write.
Yeah, for me, I stopped playing video games and I stopped watching TV, and I was spending several hours a day doing those two things. So I'm still able to get as much reading done as I was before, and I just replaced some of my passive media consumption with my active media production. And I think we can all do that. It's just difficult to do. I mean, writing is a lot like dieting and exercise. It's something that we all wish we could do more of, and we have a hard time finding the willpower to do any of it. So yeah, there's really no answer to it other than you have to just buck up and stop thinking about it and dedicate yourself to it. And if you can't do that, you know, if you can't write every single day, your chances of making it as a writer are kind of really difficult.
I think people don't realize the impact of, like, let's say you just write 500 words a day. Well, by the end of a year, that's 180,000 words.
That's two novels.
Which again, many traditionally published authors write like three or four great novels in their lives. Like if you're writing two novels a year or more, it's enormous. People don't realize the impact of a little bit of a day, how quickly that adds up to something significant.
Yeah. And if you do that for 5 years, your first two novels might not be great. And that's part of writing a lot of novels is you have to write a couple just to learn what you, just to get better. And so you do that for 5 years, let's say that gets you, five novels that aren't so good, but it gets you five novels that are great. That's enough to, 5 years later to sit and try to market and, or at least, if nothing else, be proud of. But I think anybody who dedicates 5 years to writing every single day has a good chance of making supplemental income off their work.
How many books did you have out before you quit your job?
I believe Wool was my ninth title.
Your ninth title. So nine novels or novelettes or whatever you want to call them, you had written and published before you quit your day job.
Correct. Yeah. And I had planned on, this was 2.5 years in. I'd planned on writing for 10 years before I even worried about what I was making off my writing.
So in 2.5 years, you wrote nine novels.
Let's see. It was seven novels, a novelette, and then Wool was my ninth, which was a novelette. And then I had some short stories that I'd also put on my website for free.
And just as an aside, I have to tell you, The Plagiarist and The Hurricane, I think that's the title. Those were two of my favorites as well. I enjoyed Wool, but I really liked some of your, your standalone science fiction, and The Hurricane was more young adult, but I really enjoyed those books as well.
Yeah, I have a lot of people tell me that The Hurricane is my best work, and that was, my first or second NaNoWriMo book. That's National Novel Writing Month is something I recommend to anyone who wants to make a living as a writer, because it teaches you the value of writing every day. If you miss a single day, like you use 500 words a day as your goal. If you miss a day, you have to write 1,000 words the next day in order to maintain your pace. If you miss that second day, now you're up to 1,500 words. And so you can really, the same is true of eating right and exercising. Taking one day off just snowballs into taking a week or a month off. And that's you just can't do that if this is your goal and what you want to do with your life. You have to be consistent. And NaNoWriMo teaches that better than any other program out there.
And you know, it's not just the word count. I find for myself, if I don't write every day, then my writing is not as strong the next day. Like I have to kind of stay at kind of this consistent, I don't know, it's almost like a muscle that you have to keep in shape, or else you have to, you know, reduce how much you can weightlift because you won't be as strong anymore.
Not only that, I think my best writing comes from when I'm writing a lot. The idea that it takes 5 years to write a novel, the disjointed mess that I would write if I spent 5 years writing a novel, it would be atrocious. I think when people say they spent 5 years writing a novel, it means they started it and then they procrastinated for 5 years and then they finished it.
Right.
My best writing comes when I'm writing 5,000 words in a day. That's when I stay in my book and in my character's mind, and the words are flowing. And I don't think people should have a word count, because the danger of that is that, let's say you aim for 500, usually 500 words just primes my pump and my next 2,000 words are great. But if you set a hard goal for yourself, then when you hit that goal, you give yourself an excuse to say, okay, I'm done. I'm going to walk away from it.
Right. That's a really good point.
You should write as much as you can in a day and set aside the number of hours, and don't give yourself a word count goal. Just say, I'm going to write as much as I can for 2 hours. And if that's one perfect sentence that's going to resonate in your reader's minds for years, that's 2 hours well spent. If it's 10,000 words of action and an adventure that people are going to stay up till 3 o'clock in the morning because they can't put the book down, that's 2 hours well spent. It's just, you know, use every bit of free time that you have to further your novel along, and eventually you'll complete it.
Do you heavily outline in advance, or do you let it just flow?
I do a lot of brainstorming to know my story in advance, but I don't write it. I make notes, but I don't write a heavy outline. And then I think the best method for me to get writing done is to daydream the next day. Like I'll do my writing this morning, which I've already completed. And then I'll spend the rest of my day thinking about tomorrow's writing, the one scene that I need to write that day. It could be, you know, two characters meeting. It could be them traveling a little bit, or a bar scene, or whatever it is. I daydream that scene all day long. And so when I sit down to write tomorrow, I'll know that scene. I'll know some of the conversations they have. I'll know what needs to happen during that entire scene. And if I finish that scene in my head, I'll daydream a little further along. But I always have to know where my story ends. Lost, the TV show, showed us what not to do when it comes to plotting. You have to know what your story is about and what that final scene is going to be like in order to have some destination to move toward. Otherwise, I think books just, when I'm reading, I can tell when the author did not know what was going to happen next, and that those books never resonate as much with me.
That's really interesting you bring up Lost, because the story, every step of the way, was so powerful and so intriguing, and yet you could tell, particularly in the last two or three episodes, you could tell the writers in the beginning really had no clue how this was going to end.
Yeah, and that you can write some of your best stuff when you're writing by the seat of your pants, because you're just surprising yourself all the time, and you're just making stuff up and making sure something exciting is happening at every turn. But it's easy to do that and to write adventures for which there are no adequate solutions to. And then you get it to MacGuffins and Deus Ex Machina and all these ways of, you know, it's all a dream, just ways of tying things up that are less than satisfying. I would much rather have foreshadowed events that if you read my novels a second time, you can see these hints dropped in very early that kind of tell you exactly what the story is going to be about. And you just don't notice them the first time around.
Although, so Wool eventually ended up being, you know, Wool, Shift, and Dust, like the whole kind of silo saga. Did you, when you were writing Wool, did you know how, you know, 12 novelettes later, how it was going to, you know, wrap up, like in terms of sequel and prequels and all of that?
No, when I wrote Wool, that was the entire story. So I didn't have anything else that I wanted to write in that world. The only reason I went back and, I mean, if you've read the novel, you know that after that first story, there's really nothing left to write about this character. So you have to start a new story in the same world about new characters. And that's what I did. I didn't really try to pick up with existing characters. I used the second book to transition to a new character who took over for the rest of the story.
And right. And I think that's what made, in general, that it's like you built a world, populated it with characters, and every character really could have a story. Like, you were shifting, you know, character stories quite a bit throughout the whole series. And that allows even the fan fiction to be popular. So you have a lot of fans who have now written books within your world and, you know, focusing on their own characters.
Yeah, I mean, we have to, if we're able to invent one character, then we should have the freedom to move to other characters or to kill off characters and introduce other people in other parts of the world. It's just, I think we get so attached to our characters and we're so mystified by our ability to create them, even as writers who know we can do this. It still seems magical when you do it, that I think we get a little too attached to our characters. And I think for world building, it's helpful to be able to take that ability to invent people and invent crowds of them and jump around and flesh out the world a little bit more. And that also gives you the freedom to kill off main characters, which heightens the tension. You know, I think we're getting spoiled in books and movies and TV shows where we know, yeah, a lot of dangerous stuff will happen, but nothing bad will happen to my main character. But once a show or a book shows that they're willing to do that, to kill the protagonist, that creates a lot of tension for the rest of the series.
So let me ask you this. So let's say a listener has a book they've written, doesn't matter how many pages, 30 pages or 500 pages, and now they want to publish, but they don't want to go through the whole publishing route, and they want to move to self-publishing just like you did. Technically, what should they do? Like, what's kind of an outline of steps to get your book up and out there, like, in the next week or two?
Well, I'll tell you what I would recommend, and you should get a lot of other opinions, because everyone has, you know, I have my own experiences, but other people would have their anecdotal evidence and their own biases. But I think there are three formats to concentrate on, and I prefer using Amazon services for all three, because they're tightly integrated, and I see Amazon as being the bookseller, best and number one bookseller in the world. So it's where I want to focus all my efforts. For the ebook, I focus on KDP, which is the Kindle Direct Publishing. All three of these services, by the way, are completely free. Everyone who has an Amazon account already has a KDP account. You can use your same login and password for buying stuff on Amazon to log into KDP and upload your first book. For print books, I use CreateSpace. There are other print-on-demand books that have better distribution into bookstores like Lightning Source, but CreateSpace is tightly integrated into Amazon. It shows up quicker. There are no fees for setting your book up. The copies you order for yourself are very inexpensive. Your proof copies are inexpensive. You can even do a digital proof online and not pay a penny to produce your print book. And then ACX, which is the Audible format, is also a company owned by Amazon. And then what that does is it populates your Amazon product page with three different formats. Makes it look a little more professional and gives the reader options, and also shows the ebook as being a discounted price from the print book, which is very helpful. Having print books is crucial. You can take them to events and do signed copies and stuff like that.
Yeah. So I'll just add, so I've traditionally published five books, and I've self-published about five books, and I use the exact same three parts of Amazon. So CreateSpace, Kindle Direct, Audible. I didn't always do audio, but I found, again, populating that page makes the book look more professional. And actually, I found, like, I kind of write more self-help or personal improvement. I found that I was getting a lot of sales through my Audible book that I did not expect. I was surprised.
Are you doing your own readings?
Yes, I'm doing my own readings, and I do them completely unabridged. I can't really read off of a page. I get a little bored. So I just kind of riff while I'm reading my book.
Oh, that's cool. See, I love your Facebook posts, your blog posts. I think they're really useful. So knowing that you're creating that sort of content for the audio format, probably the first thing I look up after we get off the air here.
Did you do your own readings for Audible?
No, I've done one only because they asked. It was an autobiographical piece that I did for the Kindle Worlds program in Kurt Vonnegut's world. My wife and I went up to New York, and they put us in a booth, and we did the audio for that. She did Montana Wild Hacks parts, and I did my autobiographical parts.
Oh, that's great. Did you just out of curiosity, did you use John Marshall?
Studios? I may have. It was Brilliance Audio set it up, and I think it may have been John Marshall's near Times Square, just a little north and west of Times Square.
Yeah, that's who I use as well. That's who I think Harry Potter used their facility as well, and Bill Clinton used their facility.
Oh, so I did. I remember seeing his work on the wall there when you walk in.
Yeah. So 9 books in, you use Amazon for everything from beginning to end. You have a book done from beginning to end. How long is before it appears on Amazon using all their tools?
Well, once you have the final manuscript, if you hit publish on the ebook, and it's usually up within 12 hours, sometimes less than that. With the CreateSpace book, once you finalize the proof and hit OK, it's usually up within a day. Audio takes longer. They do a quality assurance. So if someone has to listen to the whole thing, I believe, before they make that live, it usually takes a couple of weeks once you submit the final files.
Right. And so I want to stress how different this is from traditional publishing. Like when you finish a book with a traditional publisher, it could sometimes take up to a year before it's published.
Yeah. And what you're paid on your advance is sometimes tied to the on publication date. And it might be tied to different formats. So let's say a third of it is on signing, a third is on hardback publication, and a third of that might be on the paperback publication. So it could be 2 years before you get the last third of your advance, depending on how it was structured.
Then the agent takes a cut, then the government takes a cut. And meanwhile, Amazon, they're about T plus 60, right? So if you sell something in June, then by August you get the check for it.
Correct. Yeah. If it's at the end of June, it's just a little over a month before it, you know, everything in June gets paid 60 days later. So yeah, it's pretty well. I think publishers are having to respond to that. I've already seen publishers doing sales portals where you can see monthly sales data by format. Random House has added a new sales portal, and I think publishers are going to have to get on to monthly royalty reports and direct deposits to compete. So we're going to see some excellent benefits trickle down to the rest of the publishing world because of what these digital retailers are doing. And I will say, you know, I publish on KDP, but I like using KDP Select, which is a 90-day exclusivity period. But once that's over, I also publish to Kobo and the iBookstore and Nook because it's free to do it. You might as well get as many formats out there as you can.
Although, let me just say, with KDP Select, you don't get to use iBooks or Kobo or Barnes & Noble, but people can lend your books out. And Amazon has a weird way of paying they have like a pool. And so you get your pro rata portion of the pool based on how many books you've lent out. And that could actually be significant money if people are lending your books to their friends and stuff. So it could actually work out to be better results than, I mean, I'm not trying to sell anything here, but it could be better results than iBooks or Kobo or whatever.
Yeah, I can say that I lost money by going out of Select and offering my book in other outlets when I was doing really well 2 years ago because there weren't enough sales in the other outlets and I was losing the lending bonuses and the extra product placement from Kindle Select. But I had so many, you know, I was making enough to make a comfortable living. And at that point I was getting emails from people who had other devices who didn't either know that their device also read Kindle books or they didn't know how to do that. And so I kind of succumbed to the reader pressure to have as many formats out there as possible. But you're right. It can be, you can lose money by offering your book in more places paradoxically.
Yeah, and it's interesting that people who, like, for instance, have an iPad aren't always aware that there's a Kindle app there's a Kindle app for every device, essentially. But I think that's over time people will realize that Kindle dominates the universe, so they'll just switch to that from their Nook or Kobo or whatever.
Well, for me, it's like iTunes with my music. I don't want to have my library spread out everywhere, and even on my PC, purchasing my works through iTunes, which I find to be the best website for discovery of new songs and to sample and listen to songs. But because that's where I started buying my music, you know, years ago, It just makes sense to have it all in one place. I can log into any device and access my entire iTunes library. And the same is true for Amazon and their ebooks. Once you start buying books through Amazon, it doesn't make sense to have them everywhere else. You know, you have all your, so you really get locked in to one device and one marketplace. And for me, it's kind of a no-brainer which one to choose. I mean, the Nook is, there's a lot of talk about being spun off from the physical store. I like what Kobo does, and I like their devices, but I don't know that it's as stable as what Amazon has. So,
well, I'm curious now, your coworker from the bookstore, he kind of had this, you sort of alluded to, he was looking down on either genre fiction, and I find a lot of people look down on just self-publishing in general, and not as much now as, let's say, 5 years ago, and not as much then as 10 years earlier, but there's always been a slight stigma, or it used to be bigger, but there's a stigma against self-publishing. And how have you encountered that? And, you know, now let's start moving into, you also have this site, authorearnings.com, where you really dive down on the numbers of how much self-published authors make versus traditionally published authors. And also, you know, there's kind of the quality issue, like, does traditional publishing really produce higher quality in general on average? And what's some of your discoveries on that? Like, can self-publishers make a living, and do self-publishers write better or worse books according to the readers?
Well, there's a lot of topics to cover all at once.
Answer them all in 5 minutes.
So I think self-published authors are generating the same quality of content that people going the traditional route are producing. And I know that's probably controversial to say, but the difference is we see all self-published books. The books people that choose to go the traditional route, we don't see all those books. We only see the ones that publishers produce. That's what their curation and their gatekeeping powers. We only see the top 1% of books that go the traditional route. With self-publishing, I think we should really only look at the top 1% of self-published books. And that ignores people would consider the slush pile. And there's some books that I've written that are part of the slush pile that are not my best works and that I wouldn't want to include in the top 1% of books. So I include myself in that category. And there are a lot of traditionally published authors who not all of their books, you know, they all have a couple of books in their drawer that no one will ever see. When you compare the two top 1% against each other, and anyone out there who takes writing seriously and devotes time and energy into it and takes the craft seriously, they can get themselves into the top 1%. You have a lot of people who aren't trying very hard that you're not really competing against. When we compare those two, tips of the icebergs together, which is what we do when we look at the top 50,000 rated books on Amazon, for instance, what we see is that readers review the self-published works higher. There are a lot of reasons why that might be. One is possibly that we're producing more of the kinds of works that readers want. There's a bias in the publishing industry to publish more literary works and the kinds of things that the people who work in publishing enjoy. But that would be like promoting opera rather than promoting cinema. You know, just because you have high taste, that does not influence what the market wants. The market wants cinema, not opera. And even though I try to write as lyrically as possible and as high quality prose as possible, I'm writing the types of stories that I want to read where lots of exciting things happen. And that tends to be what self-publishing provides to readers: more genre fiction, more romance and action and adventure and science fiction and what used to be considered pulp. And we can denigrate that if we want, but I mean, traditional publishing has made its living publishing biographies of people like Snooki and whatever they think will sell. And for some reason, in the nonfiction categories with self-help and religious texts and other things, they are willing to cater to reader demand, but And the genre works just does not seem like they are willing to output as many works a year as those readers will consume.
Right. So in terms of money now, let's say, what would you say is the kind of comparison between the top 1% of traditional versus self-publishing? As you mentioned, you're an outlier, but can one make a living from self-publishing, in your opinion?
Yes, you can. There are several reasons why you can. one, now you have much higher royalty rates with self-publishing. You're talking 70% for digital versus 12.5% off the list price. So if you're self-published, you make 70% of what the book sells for. If you're traditionally published, you're going to make around 12.5% of the list price. People will say that 70% of the market is still print, which I think is not accurate. But even if that is true, that 70% is not what the author is making. The author might make, 12% of the list price. The retailer and the publisher make more on the sale of the book than the author does. So you're not giving up much when you self-publish on the print side, but you're gaining a lot on the digital side. And what we saw when we compared the top 50,000 books on Amazon were the self-published books were earning more in that daily snapshot for self-published authors than traditionally published authors were making.
Is that per author or across the whole group?
Well, it's an average earnings per author. So and then we also broke it down to how much authors were making in each bracket. And from the outliers, which were dead even, the people making seven figures, all the way to the people making a few thousand dollars a year, where the self-published authors vastly outnumbered the traditionally published authors. In every one of these categories, self-published authors were doing better. It also turns out that Amazon appears to be making more money from self-published authors than from traditionally published books. So, yeah, the results were pretty startling. And
that must be why Amazon has so little friction between, as you mentioned, it's all of their services are free to the writer. Like, it's a very writer-friendly environment.
It's massive because they when we think that 70% royalty is outrageous, but it's really a really fair rate. When you think about it's not really a royalty, it's a distribution agreement. We're providing them a finished product that they only have to list and put on sale and handle the transaction side. They're not doing editorial. They're not handling cover art. They're not doing print distribution and all that stuff. That's what publishers do. And so they pay the author a royalty. What Amazon is paying you is similar to what a bookstore pays a publisher to carry a book. And at my bookstore, we typically got a 40 to 45% discount off of a book's retail price, which means we paid 55 to 60% to the publisher, and we had to warehouse and staff and sell the physical book. So what Amazon's doing is they're taking a finished product and charging 30%, where we used to charge 40% for a digital book versus a print book. So it's a very fair transaction, very sustainable. And it's a higher rate than they're paying their traditionally published books, where they might only make 10 to 20% per sale of a book. And I think it might be a lot less than that.
Now, are you ever disturbed by the fact that self-published authors don't make it into the bookstores? Because, for instance, at least for most authors, most self-published authors, Amazon doesn't offer the return policy that traditional publishers do.
You can make it into bookstores if your book does well enough. I mean, for the outliers, the bookstores will carry your print-on-demand books. I've seen this personally, and I know other authors who aren't near my level of sales that are seeing their books show up in bookstores, and they've had success getting their books in a Barnes & Noble. I've got a friend who's done several signings in his area in Barnes & Noble and has been very well supported by them. I think this will change. I mean, we're very early in this process, but I would not be surprised to see CreateSpace do some sort of pooled marketing where they would have sales reps and view their CreateSpace books as their own in-house books, and they would go to bookstores with a catalog and say, hey, these are our top sellers. This is the book we're most excited about that just came out. These are the books we think you should carry, and basically do what publishers are already doing and offer books returnable and just eat the cost. I don't think they'll actually return the books to readers or to writers. I don't think they'll ding their accounts. I'm not sure how they'll work that, but my guess is that they could be profitable and eat the returns the way publishers do.
Well, again, I find Amazon to be incredibly writer friendly. So when they have to make a decision that's either for the writer or against the writer, they usually make that decision for the writer, even if it hurts their immediate bottom line, because they're looking at this long term. They're creating a long term ecosystem for all writers. So I think that helps the writer.
I've seen this over and over again with Amazon, where and we read their clauses and we read what their lawyers wrote and everyone freaks out. But when you deal with the people at Amazon, they make common sense decisions and they ignore their contracts. And they'll say, look, this is what makes sense. And they'll every time they've had to make a decision like that, they've made it against their own best interests and for the writer. And I'm baffled by that because, you know, I've also worked with traditional publishers and it doesn't work that way. It's also the only company that's ever called me to say, and this is before I had this level of success that I've had, but called and said like, hey, what can we do better? You know, just as a random survey sort of thing. And I know a lot of authors that they've called like that and they bring in to look at new products and systems and say, what can we do to improve this? And I think,
I just want to mention. So just 2 days ago, I was at Amazon because I met every single division of Kindle and CreateSpace and so on. And I was astonished how humble they were and every group asking, what can we do better to help you? And it was really, great to see that in action.
Yeah. Well, it's what's amazing. Self-published authors know a lot about marketing and a lot about their readership. And I think this is something that publishers, the New York publisher, should really tap into. They should really contact their writers and say, hey, what are you noticing? What can we do better? They should really pull those resources. It's an unbelievable tool at their disposal. And Amazon's taking advantage of that and other publishers should as well. They're already doing that in the marketing side. You know, when you sign a contract with a publisher, there's this assumption that if you're with a big publisher, they're going to handle everything for you. But the first thing they'll ask, as you mentioned earlier, is how big is your social media platform? How many Twitter followers do you have? How are you going to sell your book? And I think that'll surprise a lot of aspiring writers when they get that first contract that their publisher is asking them what they're going to do to sell the book. And but that's the reality. They have to leverage the muscle of all of those authors in their stable. And they can do that as well for market research as well as they do on the actual sales and marketing side.
So why did you decide to do this authorearnings.com? Like, what was your goal with that? And because it was a lot of work. I see you've put a lot of work into analyzing the data.
Yeah, it's been a lot of work and, you know, a lot of money hosting the site and getting things put up and formatted. My motivation has been the same for the last several years. You know, I've been trying to do what I can with my agent, with our negotiations with publishers to make changes in the way publishers deal with manuscripts and with authors. You know, I think we should have limited terms of license. I think royalty rates should be better for digital works. There's no reason publishers should make a higher profit margin off an ebook that they make off a hardback. Right. And we've seen changes in every other entertainment and media format in Hollywood when digital streaming became a revenue stream. The writers had to strike basically to get what was a fair payment for their work. And I don't think that'll happen in the publishing world without pressure from self-published authors. Because right now publishers just don't compete with one another. They compete on the size of advance, which the differences there are small. They'll go to auction and they'll have, you know, competition there, but their contracts are boilerplate and they resemble each other too much. And I think we need, so the reason for that website, you know, an author contacted me with the first bit of data from Amazon that anyone had ever really seen and a very clever way of coming up with that data. And I saw this as being really hard proof of what I'd already seen anecdotally for years. If you're in the trenches, this matches everything that you're seeing from authors on both sides of this equation. Dissatisfaction from traditionally published authors and complete befuddlement from self-published authors who can't believe how much money they're making, whether it's several hundred dollars a month or hundreds of thousands of dollars a month. There are people that you've never heard of that are making six and seven figures a year. And those stories are popping up everywhere. And it's hard to rationalize until you see this data and you realize, oh my God, self-published authors are out earning traditionally published authors on Amazon.
Well, and I think what's particularly important is what you mentioned earlier. It's not just that they're making it on one book. A lot of times, I mean, I know some authors who have written over 100 books and, you know, all it takes is like $100 per month per book. And if you've written 100 books, you're making like a good living, you know, in the United States.
Yeah, it's incredible. Well, you know, that's one of the things that we were concerned about when we saw this, these earnings, and we were able to, we have the author names, so we're able to see how many books they were earning across and what their total earnings were. And so one of the things that we looked for was, well, is the difference in earnings only because they're publishing more books? Well, that was only true of the authors earning seven figures. In every other bracket, self-published authors were earning more money on fewer titles than traditionally published authors. So
you know what's interesting also, and your numbers probably don't cover this, is many self-published authors are in charge of how their books get distributed, as opposed to letting the publisher be in charge of how your books get distributed. So for instance, for me, I often will bulk buy a print order and then sell through an email list. And so that doesn't get reflected at all in terms of how much I'm making, because I could put together bundles of my books. And I think there's a lot of creative ways that self-published authors can market and sell and distribute their books, which is also interesting.
Yeah, and you can give books away if you want. I mean, through CreateSpace, I can get copies of my books for like $3 or $4 each, which is cheaper than some other marketing materials that you might, you know, if you wanted to give away thumb drives or other doodads at a conference, giving away the book itself is cheaper than a lot of those things. I know people who, they get really fancy business cards that are about $1 each. Well, I can print a novelette for $1 and hand that out. So
yeah,
it's,
you know,
it's hard to do that through a publisher.
You know what I did with my last book? I had all 67,000 words printed onto a T-shirt. And so you can actually read on the T-shirt every single word. It's readable. And I sometimes give that away.
Was that through Lithograph?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, they approached me at AWP and wanted to do that with one of my works. I thought that was brilliant. I couldn't believe you can print that much onto a T-shirt. But they showed me one. I was dumbfounded.
Yeah, so one of the things I wanted to do when I was up at Amazon just, again, 2 days ago, was allow them to let me put a T-shirt slot on the title page instead of, along with the Audible paperback hardcover, also T-shirt, because the whole book's there.
Yeah, that's brilliant.
So now I want to ask you also, like, switching topics, like Ridley Scott calls you and wants to buy the movie rights for Wall. What happened? How excited were you? When's the movie coming out?
Well, I first thing I did was change my pants and told everybody I knew. My expectation and with everything to do with my writing has been so low that when the movie talk started, I just assumed no movie would ever come out because a lot of stuff gets optioned. Very few things get made. But everything that's happened since then, I just feel like they're trying to get my hopes up before they dash them, you know, on a rock somewhere. We've gone through they've written a screenplay and we've had all these pre-production meetings and everyone seems to be really excited about it. The screenplay is brilliant. So I still tell myself it'll never happen, but.
Did you help write the screenplay?
No, I met with the screenwriter. He's from London and they flew me and him to LA and we spent a week together brainstorming and going over his notes, but I've agreed with his vision from the beginning. He knows what the heart of the story is about, and he's captured that in the screenplay.
And have you met with a lot with Ridley Scott, or is he kind of hands off until production?
Yeah, I think he would just show up to if the movie won awards, that's when he would show up to collect all those and put them in his trophy case. He's a busy guy, and he's got all. I mean, to be honest, like the movies that I know that he's working on, there are a lot more that I'd rather him see as a fan make before Wolf. So I it's one of the reasons I'll be surprised that this gets made.
Well, are any actors interested yet? Like, to how far along are you in the process?
We haven't done the casting yet, but I know actors who have read the book who have contacted me privately or in person and said that they are, especially female actresses who are dying to play Juliet. I was at a conference in Australia and some of the media stars there started passing the book around and there was a lot of infighting about who was going to get to be Juliet. So that was pretty cool. But if we do casting, that would probably be the next step and it would be sometime this year.
Wow. And if, let's say, I know you keep your expectations low, but let's say we were to have high expectations, when do you think a movie could come out?
My guess would be next summer. If they not this upcoming summer, but summer of 2015. They would probably, if they cast it this year, they would probably be filming in the fall and wrapping up and doing post-production in the spring and releasing in the summer of 2015. But that's like absolute best case scenario. And again, that's not my expectation at all.
So Hugh, 2-3 years ago, you were like a clerk in a bookstore shelving books. Now we're talking movie next year. You've got, I don't know, 15, 20 books out. You are continuing to write, obviously. Like what, this like just blows the mind. Like how has your life changed? Like, did you buy a new house? Did you have a big party, or do you just, you know, what's going on?
I haven't had a big party. I don't have that big of a social network. My partying has been online with Facebook, but my wife and I will have celebratory glasses of wine every now and then. We had to buy a new house when we moved from North Carolina to Florida. My wife took a new job and we upgraded. We live in a 750 square foot house in North Carolina, and we upgraded to a 900 square foot house here in Florida.
Wow, a 20% improvement.
Yeah. And, you know, it's so instead of bedrooms that are like 10 feet by 10 feet, they're now like 12 feet by 12 feet. And we're really confused what to do with all the extra space. It's been pretty amazing. But, you know, financially, it's a weird situation where I don't have to work for the rest of my life. You know, I can write duds and flops for the rest of my life, but I don't think about it that way. You know, I'm living the same lifestyle and, you know, still eat the same cereal every morning and wear the same t-shirts and shorts and just concentrate on the writing and enjoying life, which was my philosophy beforehand.
Well, it's really interesting because a lot of people always ask the wrong question, which is, how can I make a lot of money? But what they don't realize is that money is a side effect. Like if you're doing something really well, then A, you'll tend to love what you're doing as opposed to the other way around. Like if you know, some people, you know, people always say, find what you love and then do that. But I find if you do something really well, like writing, say, you'll love it automatically. And then money's just a side effect of that. And you don't really have to change your lifestyle because you love what you're doing all of a sudden. And you love what's happening during the day. You don't write on a you know, private jet or anything. You write in your home.
Yeah. I think if people go into writing, and we see this with the people claim that self-publishing is a gold rush. Well, you know, there are a lot of elements of traditional publishing that have the same mentality. You know, there's a big catastrophe or some big news event and everyone jumps on writing and pitching that book immediately. And so I think any comparison you can make with or anything you could say about one of these routes of publishing, you can say about the other. What I will say is if you go into this to make money, I just don't know how you would ever be happy because your chances of making a lot of money are very slim. Yes, they're better as a self-published author, but that's not saying a whole lot because the people who choose to traditionally publish, which means they choose to submit to agents, that doesn't mean they get their book on an end cap in a bookstore. They might not even get a publishing deal. You don't get to choose that. You just get to choose which route you're going to go. And that might mean rejection letters from agents for the rest of your life. That could be the route that you chose. So yes, you have a better chance of making money self-published. But that's only because your chances of making money traditionally published are so woefully slim. Why let money be your guide if your chances either route are that bad? This is where self-publishing really wins, not on the monetary side, but the satisfaction of writing a story that you believe in and making it available to the public and getting just one reader to pick that book up and enjoy it, that's almost a guaranteed outcome if you dedicate yourself to self-publishing. By the time you write 5 or 6 completed works, you will have found one reader and made them happy. And if you stick to that as your goal, there's no way you can lose. It's just, it's such a liberating feeling to know that your success and all of your efforts and all of the ownership of your art, it's all in your hands.
And we both know writers who, like, take Teresa Reagan as an example. She had been trying to traditionally publish for a decade or more until finally she went the self-publishing route. And now, just through self-publishing, she's a massive bestseller in both the romance and thriller categories.
Yeah, and I guarantee, I mean, she's made a lot of money doing something that she loved that she could easily have given up on the other way. That's another huge advantage is self-publishing inspires people to continue writing. I know I've got really good friends who have been who are published with big five publishers who have given up on writing because of how their careers have been handled. They had something that they loved doing and the business side of it took all the passion out of it for them. And with self-publishing, I mean, again, it's a paradox because you think you'd be busier, but if it takes me 2 months to write a novel, it takes me 2 days to publish it. So when you think of like all the stuff you have to learn and all the headaches of self-publishing, you can do it in a weekend. You can get your ebook, your print book, and your audiobook set up and formatted and ready to go in a weekend. And that's not a lot of investment in time.
No, it's been really amazing for me as well. I have to say it's changed my life. And this is after having traditionally published, you know, I published with HarperCollins, with Penguin, with Wiley, five different books, and self-publishing has been amazing for me. But what are you working on now? Like, do you work on like a bunch of books at the same time or do you focus on one at a time? Like, what's your next bunch of projects?
I try to focus on one at a time. Right now I'm moving several projects forward to see which one's going to grab my attention. I just published really three works this year already. That short story in the Kurt Vonnegut world for the Kindle Worlds program, a novel called Sand, which has been a bestseller, and then an anthology with John Joseph Adams called The End Is Nigh, with where I edited 22 short stories and contributed one of those and helped produce and self-publish the books. We just got that out a couple weeks ago. So the last couple of weeks I've spent in the Fifth Molly book playing around and also starting a couple of new novels and just see which one captures my attention. Probably the next week or two, I'll pick one and run forward with that for a couple of months until that one's finished.
Well, that's great. So Hugh, thank you so much for coming on this show. I really think you're living the dream and congratulations for all your success. And also I think you're really helping move forward, you know, getting rid of the traditional stigma that's been associated with self-publishing and showing people that this is a viable route to either express yourself creatively or to even make a living. And you've been doing that really well. So thanks again for spending the time and coming on this show.
Thanks, James. It's an honor, and I'll do it anytime, man.
Excellent. Thanks, Hugh.
Well, James, that was an excellent interview. What's the one big takeaway that you had?
You know, it's really interesting to me that here's a guy who followed his dreams. He kept his expectations low and then he blew away those expectations. Now, not everyone is going to write a best-selling novel. And note, it took him 9 novels to write a best-selling novel. But I guarantee you, for just about everyone, there is something you can do where if you're persistent and you keep, you know, your positive expectations high, you know, you keep your optimism high, you're going to find success. You're going to be able to choose yourself and find freedom. Everyone wants freedom of choice in their lives. Hugh found it through writing. Other people find it through building apps. Other people find it through owning a franchise or investing or whatever. But there's always a way. And if you do what you do well, you'll end up doing what you love. And money is the side effect of that, and freedom is the side effect of that. So I encourage everybody to choose this route, really.
Yeah, that's great, James. It's a theme that you have over and over, and it's what a lot of your guests have pretty much done with their lives. You know, they've all kind of bottomed out at some point, chose themselves, and it pays off, but it is scary. You know, one of my favorite sayings I ever heard was, when one door closes, another one opens, but sometimes it's hell in the hallway. And it's good to go to the new door.
Yeah, exactly. That's a good analogy. And it's one to think of even when you're being persistent in the same area. Like just because some agent rejected your book. You know, I tried to write fiction 20 years ago and I wrote 4 or 5 novels. I got rejected everywhere. And then I started publishing nonfiction. And then my most recent book, Choose Yourself, I totally self-published. I used the exact same techniques and the exact same companies that Hugh talks about in the interview. And my book, the day it was published, hit #1 for all nonfiction on Amazon over every other book in the world. So it's possible and it is the dream. So, and everybody's got a dream and I encourage everybody to pursue it.
That's awesome. And one more note for the listeners out there. You know, we talked about doing the Ask Altucher segment where it's a daily podcast, about 10 minutes long. We've recorded a series of those. We're just doing the technological ends of it right now, but we should have those up in the next couple of days or so. And it's the chance for all the listeners out there to ask you a question or go to your Twitter, which you do a Q&A every Thursday. What is it, between 3:30 and 4:30? I forget the exact time.
Yes.
Between 3:30 and 4:30. And your Twitter handle is at James Altucher. Is that right?
Yeah. And people ask me anything. You could ask me about relationships, divorce, hate, anger, anxiety, fear, startups. People ask me anything. I answer on the spot. But now, Aaron, now that we're doing this Ask Altucher, we'll be able to also take kind of the best and most interesting questions and expand on them further.
That's outstanding. And also, you can also email James at, you go to the email address, james@stansberryradio.com. That's james@stansberryradio.com. I hand select these. I'll ask you one a day. We started it. We'll get them up and running real soon. So please, we encourage everybody to do that. And James, another phenomenal podcast. I know your guest lineup that you have coming up. It's spectacular. I'm really looking forward to these, and I hope everybody else just hangs in there and keeps listening.
Honestly, I can't believe some of these people said yes to coming on the podcast, some of the guests that we have coming up. But it's really I'm excited. I'm excited to talk to some of them since some of the interviews haven't happened yet.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, James, well, another spectacular show, and we'll talk to the listeners soon.
Thanks, Aaron.
Stansberry Radio is a purely public broadcast and is not intended to be personalized financial advice for any individual specific situation. Each individual's financial situation is unique, and Stansberry Radio should not be relied upon and or considered as personalized advice. Stansberry Radio is not licensed to render personalized advice and should be considered simply the public opinions of Stansberry Radio and its guests. Recommendations on specific financial securities are not intended to address any listener's particular financial situation.
You seek the key, but first you must learn the ways of precision, craft, and performance with Acura's all-electric ZDX. With a premium Bang & Olufsen sound system, up to a 313-mile range, and a Type S variant with an estimated 500 horsepower, the ZDX is their most powerful SUV yet. Unlock the energy when you visit Acura.com to order yours today.